Okay. Nice to see you all. So tonight's talk is going to be on, or at least in some way, on the four great vows. And I gave a talk on the four great vows back in January, and then recently one or two members of the Spiritual Friends Act, thought it might be a good idea to do it again. So I'm doing it again, and so I'm sure a lot of what I share will be some might be some similar stuff, and maybe one or two same stories from last time, but also different stuff. And I'm sure not. I don't think all of you were here last time, so maybe it won't be burdening your ears with repeats, I hope. But anyway, so the four great vows in Buddhism, I have two translations which I'll read. The first translation is the one that I'm really familiar with, because it is the one that's used in my root sangha, Zen sangha, the Kwannon school of Zen. And it's, sentient beings are numberless, we vow to save them all. Delusions are endless, we vow to cut through them all. The teachings are infinite, we vow to learn them all. And the Buddha way is inconceivable, we vow to attain it. And then another version, just to give you another take on it, which I found, I think I got this from Upaya Zen Center, if I remember correctly, up in Santa Fe. Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to transform them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The awakened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. So I'm going to read the first translation just one more time. Sentient beings are numberless, we vow to save them all. Delusions are endless, we vow to cut through them all. The teachings are infinite, we vow to learn them all. And the Buddha way is inconceivable, we vow to attain it. So these vows are very dear to me, because in my root sangha, whenever practicing in one of the centers or doing a retreat, they're repeated. We repeat them all together every morning and then every evening. And I lived in Zen centers in that sangha for many, many years. So from my young practice days, these were very much part of the practice. And they're very, very dear to me. And they've always been very, very meaningful and a great, great guide for me. And these, the vows, we hear them, they all express things that are kind of impossible, right? Sentient beings are numberless. We vow to save them all. How do you save beings if they're number, like all of them? If they're numberless, how do you save them all? That's impossible. Delusions are inexhaustible. We got to cut through them all. Another impossibility. They're exhaustible. If there's no end to delusions, how can we possibly cut through them all? And the teachings are infinite. They're endless. But we've got to learn them all. It's also impossible. And the Buddha way is inconceivable. We vow to attain it. How do you attain something that's inconceivable? So they kind of, they express these things that are impossible, but yet they're not. And what's most important is, when we, if we just, read these, they seem like things that are otherworldly, like beyond, beyond our grasp, where they're so holy or something. And that's not the point at all. What's really the essence of these is how we can practice them and embody them in our everyday life every single day. And the truth is, we have every day of our life, we have many, many opportunities to manifest these vows. And there are some days maybe where we have an opportunity, more opportunity for this one or that one, or these two or these three. But so these things really point to a real core, real essence of our practice and our practice direction. So they're not otherworldly, they're not impossible, they're not something that are some just for the those most enlightened beings or whatever, who transcended this world or and gone off to other realms or whatever. No, they're really within the right here and now. And that's what our practice is about, is how we manifest our practice and our path to Dharma in our everyday life, just in accordance with where we're at right now, or today, our practice. So I have some nice, you know, stories related, you know, that I'll share that encompass some, you know, certain aspects of the spirit of these and all. But I want to first start with a personal experience, and because that for me often is that's the most meaningful, right? Is relating it to myself. So I'm going to share with you a little something that happened just very recently, part of it happened last week, but it started before that. So so I've been experiencing for a little while, maybe a month or two, just noticing an increasingly difficult time for myself, where I was just beginning to feel my mind more constricted, less happy, and just knowing not myself, and stuck. And this was growing over time. I started feeling a kind of disconnect from myself and from my experience, and I won't go into that part too much, but I think it's attributable to a number of things. I think although, you know, my life is very good, and I, you know, things are, you know, are good, and I'm not suffering in any big way, but certainly the pandemic and the effects, you know, I'm sure it's affected us all, and some, you know, there's overlap, and there's ways that are that are different for each of us. And but just the general constriction, and I love my work, but it's really, you know, and I know I've said this in other talks before, I'm a psychotherapist, and wow, after it's over a year and a half now of, you know, doing these sessions, you know, Monday through Friday on the screen, and it's okay, and it works, and it's what we have, and it's all fine, it's okay, but gee, you know, I just miss that, the directness with my clients, that direct, you know, the presence. It's different being in each other's presence. And so so that's one thing. The work is very intense, and doing it on the screen is makes it even more exhausting. And we were, our little firm, our plan was to begin to reopen our office finally on Monday, August 2nd, so the very beginning of the month. And we were kind of all, you know, and to begin reopening it for clients who wanted to start to meet in person. So it would be some hybrid for sure, because not everyone would want that, or not every client every time. It just depends. But anyway, and so we were all really excited and looking forward to that. And then we found out that actually we would still at that point, we thought we weren't, but we would still be obliged by the book, by the state of New Mexico, and being under the medical umbrella, that we were only going to be seeing fully vaccinated clients that were all fully vaccinated. So we thought we could, you know, be without masks. We found out that no, we still have to wear the damn stupid mask. I'm not down on masks are important. I don't mean that. It's just I believe in the mask, but we thought we would finally be able to take that step. And then we found out that we couldn't. So we said, okay, we're not reopening the office, you know, and then in the last few weeks, you know, more and more, we've had this big, you know, spike too with the variant. So it became clear that our office isn't going to reopen anytime soon. So there was that. And it was kind of like, oh, okay, here, I guess, you know, we're still so much in this thing. And so, you know, a door that, a very welcome door that, you know, I thought was opening is still closed. And then because of COVID, my girlfriend, Randy, who most of you know, we had this very wonderful trip planned, which was on my dear sister and her family, my brother-in-law and two nieces that live in France. My sister's lived there for about 35 years. And we haven't seen them in 2 years. And we had a very wonderful trip planned. My sister gifted us tickets, and she had, you know, a very wonderful trip in France, and it was going to be very, very nice. And then last week, Randy and I had to make the really difficult decision that we need to cancel it because of where COVID is at, and just not we're fully vaccinated and all, but there are risks and all. So it was a very difficult decision and to cancel that trip. So, then it's like, okay, I don't know when I'm going to see my family. You know, it's going to probably be at least a year, if not more, who knows. So that was that. And then there were some other things that happened in my life recently. There were some, just some kind of like little setback things. And so I noticed that my self-confidence was kind of at a low point. And I was struggling. So then, and then with the hit of having to cancel our trip, and that's the very dearest part of my family, of those folks that are in France. So that was really hard, And so then by like the middle of last week, I was just really feeling down. And there was this accumulation. So I felt weighed down and I just didn't feel like I didn't feel clear. I was like stuck, And then one evening last week, I think it was Wednesday before we went to bed, I said to Rand, I'm depressed. I'm depressed. And it's not very often I don't know when the last time was I really felt that. I felt sadness and I've had sadness and grief, but not depressed. And I was like, I just need to, I'm saying it, I'm depressed, and it's like, Tony, the longtime Buddhist practitioner, the relatively well-reputed psychotherapist, is depressed. And I just, I got to own that. It's like, I'm just naming it, many of you are familiar with, there's a wonderful mindfulness tool approach to our emotional experience. It goes by RAIN, R-A-I-N. I'm sure probably most of you know it. Tara Brach does a lot with that. It's very, very well known in the mindfulness and meditation world. And it's recognize, accept, investigate, and non-identification. So in that moment, I was able to recognize, hey, I'm depressed. And then I was able to I worked on accepting. Can I just, I'm depressed. I'm having a hard time, And then because of where I was at, and this was like last Wednesday night, and I knew I had to give, I was, going to be giving this talk about a week later tonight. And I really felt like I'm not in a place to give a Dharma talk. And like, I don't want to, because I don't feel like, I was really feeling like I can't give a Dharma talk because I'm like this. Like, and it wasn't so much like, who am I to get up and, lead a Dharma evening and give a talk. It was just like, I don't think I'm capable because I'm not doing so good. So I just, and then I was, thinking, oh, maybe tomorrow morning I'll write an email to spiritual friends and just tell them and maybe someone can cover. And I was like, oh, I'll just see, and I went to sleep. And then in the morning when I woke up, I had a little space. And then I realized like, okay, yeah, I'm having a hard time. Because of the recognizing and accepting, and probably did a little investigation, there was some easing. It didn't have the same hold on me. And then I realized, wow, I knew my talk was on the Four Great Vows. And I said, wow, Tony, this is a real life opportunity to practice the Four Great Vows. And I can just share my experience too next week, if it's still alive for me and that's where the part of the talk is meant to go, then I will. Sorry. Dogs. Outside our apartment complex. And I realized, wow, this is my opportunity to, put this into practice. And I kind of reflected and like, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. It's like, okay, if I give in, if I just, give in to this malaise I'm feeling and let it become my identity, then I'm, then I'm really in a depression and I'm cut off from my deeper awareness and connection with myself. So what does that mean? Sentient beings are numerous, I vow to save them all. So if I give into this and I don't give this talk, then you know, and then I have to ask one of my fellow spiritual friends to cover for me. Well, I'm laying a burden on them. You know, it's different if you're like, you know, you're really sick and you can't, that's a whole different, you know, it's something else. But in this situation, then I'm, you know, I'm laying that onto someone else. I'm giving, you know, and I'm burdening another other people. So in this way, you know, one manifestation of saving all beings is doing what I signed up for, and is just showing up and not burdening another person, right? That's one way of looking at it. Delusions are endless. We've got to cut through them all. Well, this is my opportunity. Yeah, I'm in some delusion now because I'm stuck, and that's okay. That's okay. So I'm not like really so clear right now. I am kind of stuck. So, but if I can just be with this what I'm going through and my difficulty, there is, you know, one way of saying I could say is there's some manifestation of I. There's some I here that I'm that I'm stuck in, or something, whatever. So, but if I can just be and accept the fact that I'm going through this now and I'm having this difficult time, then that's my opportunity to pass through this this difficulty, and which may come with or some, you know, maybe some strands of delusion in it because of my attachment or whatever, some attachment to this I or something. So it's my opportunity to cut through some, to work through some delusion and realize something. And the teachings are internally about or we're in the mode. This is my teaching, my experience right here, my pain right now, my suffering, you know, is my teaching. So not running away from it, but just allowing it, just being with this experience. This is real life teaching. And the Buddha way is inconceivable. We vow to attain it. Well, this is my opportunity to be with my experience, and then through it to come back to a deeper awareness, deeper connection with a deeper self, whatever we want to call it. So this is my opportunity to come back into, into my own Buddha nature, whatever that is, like to pass through this. And so that was I just wanted to share that because I was really, really having a hard time. And I I appreciate that. Then I had enough space. And I realized that, yeah, this is, you know, going through my experience now and being with this, and is a beautiful opportunity to practice the four great vows in this moment, this day. And that's the beauty of these vows, or just, you know, practice at large is being with our experience and accepting it and being with it and allowing it, whatever it is. Okay. And these vows are not, they gel into each other and they overlap, and they're not like four like really distinct such separate things. They're all part of each other. So sentient beings are numerous. We've got to save them all. So we have, you know, we have all these opportunities every moment. Again, just, you know, when we're able to just be, whether it's our own pain or whatever, or just, you know, just when we are able just to be present in this moment and show up, then being with our significant other, you know, hearing another person, being there, giving a helping hand, whatever that is. You know, saving all sentient beings, it's like, that sounds like a very, again, such a otherworldly thing, but no, it is giving a helping hand. Wishing the cashier at the supermarket, whatever, a nice day. It is giving a helping hand when we can and we're able, whatever it may be. It's just through our presence and through our presence and our direction of just doing our best to be unhindered in this present moment. When we're hindered, when we're stuck, I was very stuck last week, you know, then there's a hindrance, and there's, you know, then there's a suffering there. But, you know, our practice is about just being with whatever is. And then more and more, you know, then when we're really just unhindered in this present moment, we can meet it just as it is. And we can, and then we can show up, and we can, you know, give that helping hand, or we can listen to that other person, whatever that is. So there's one story which I'll kind of tell quickly, which I know I did tell back in January, but it's a very incredible story, and I love this because it really, in this story, it embodies all the four great vows area, but it's very much about sentient beings are numerous, we vow to save them all. And so a long time ago, a couple hundred years ago, whatever, in Korea was a very famous Zen master, Kyung Ho Sinim. He was a monk, a fully ordained celibate monk. And at that time, his attendant monk was Mangang Sinim, who later got transmission and was also a very, very famous Korean Zen master. And so one time they were in some hermitage somewhere. They weren't at the big, I don't know, for some reason, Kyung Ho Sinim was at some hermitage for a while. Maybe he was doing a retreat and Mangang Sinim was there with him. So he wasn't at his big temple or whatever. And one day a woman who had leprosy came, and she was asking for some food. And so Kyung Ho Sinim gave her food. And then what he did was, and he was a fully ordained, you know, monk, full 250 precepts, and he had her stay in his room for 3 days and three nights. And he attended to her, he took care of her. The story doesn't go into details, but he stayed with her and he cared for her, and he had Mangang Sinim, his attendant monk, you know, each meal bring food for both of them. And then he just attended to her for 3 days and three nights. And then after at the end of the third day, she left. And in the meantime, Mangang Sinim, he was a young monk, and you know, with their full precepts, and he was he was confused, and then he was suffering because he was like, what is this? Like, what is my master doing? He's breaking it. I mean, who knows what happened? I don't really think it's a sexual thing, but he attended to her. So already having a woman stay in your room as a fully ordained monk is breaking the precepts. Just that is breaking, strictly speaking, by the book, is breaking the precepts, right? You're alone with a woman for 3 days and three nights. That is breaking the precepts, okay? And so Mangang Sinim was like, really, you know, with each day he was just getting more like wondering what is going on, and feeling like my master is not who I thought he was. You know, what, this is terrible. He's breaking the precepts. So after she left, and then Kyung Ho Sinim, of course, he knew it, what his attendant, his young monk, was going through, and he was very aware of that. And he told him that, you know, that woman, she, because of her leprosy, she had no human feeling anymore. It was all gone. And he said, so I took care of her for these 3 days just to give her back her, that feeling, that human feeling, that she knows that she is a human and she has her truth and herself. So that's what this was about, just giving her back her humanity. So that's great love. That's great compassion. That's unhindered. That's saving. That's a beautiful example of saving all sentient beings. And so, and Mangang Sinim, because of his deep, realization, his awakeness, he was able to do that. So he wasn't hindered by, I am a fully ordained monk. Of course I am. And if he broke his precepts, even simply by the fact of having a woman stay in his room for 3 days and three nights, that wasn't for him. He didn't do that because of his own desire or something he wanted, not at all. Just to help, to give this woman back her sense of humanity, of feeling, of a human feeling. So that's unhindered, right? So, and that's a very beautiful, I love that story, very, very profound. Very, very powerful. And so, you know, each of us in our own lives, we have, every day we have, these opportunities. And sometimes in life, you know, we may get a little bit bogged down by just the everyday life of things or whatever. But when we're really present and right here, then, you know, each moment is fresh. And so we see, oh yeah, you know, making our significant other a cup of tea, rubbing their feet, whatever, just, you know, attend in our, just being there and allowing our, through our presence and our love to manifest, that's saving all sentient beings. Delusions are endless. We vow to cut through them all. Yeah, of course we have delusions. Of course we have thinking. There's attachment to thinking. And so it's not about being clear and enlightened every single second. Of course, as long as we have this human existence and we have this body, we have thinking. Sometimes we have some delusion, some unclarity, and sometimes we have clarity. And our practice is just now. What is this? Coming back on the cushion, off the cushion. What is this? Just now coming back. And so so when there is thinking, when we're kind of stuck, maybe we're not so clear, just noticing and just being with that. And then for our practice, we're going to come back and then that'll go. I'm going to read a little thing. This is from Dropping Ashes on the Buddha, which is a book of teachings from my root Zen teacher, Zen Master Sung Sang. And this little teaching is called the Moon of Clear Mind. And so that one Sunday evening after a Dharma talk at the Providence Zen Center, a student asked Sung San, how can I get beyond just verbalizing the question, what am I? So, you know, in practice, in Dharma practice, you know, very much in Zen, but not only Zen, is often this sitting with a question, what am I? Who am I? What is this? You know, these are questions that help us go beyond the conceptual mind. And De Sansim said, so again, how can I get beyond just verbalizing the question, what am I? De Sansim said, you want this question to grow. This mind is not so good. He's Korean, so he talked in kind of broken English, and so on. In the translations, they keep a little bit of that, his teachings, although they're edited, but they keep some of that. This mind is not so good. This is attachment thinking. You must cut off this thinking and only do hard training, practice hard. It's not important for the question to grow. What's important is one moment of clear mind. Clear mind is before thinking. If you experience this mind, you have already attained enlightenment. If you experience this for a short time, even for one moment, this is enlightenment. All the rest of the time you may be thinking, but you shouldn't worry about this thinking. It is just your karma. You must not be attached to this thinking. You must not force it to stop or force clear mind to grow. Let me read that sentence again. You must not force it to stop the thinking or force clear mind to grow. It'll grow by itself as your karma gradually disappears. Clear mind is like the full moon in the sky. Sometimes clouds come and cover it, but the moon is always behind them. Clouds go away, then the moon shines brightly. So don't worry about clear mind. It's always there. When thinking comes, behind it is clear mind. When thinking goes, there is only clear mind. Thinking comes and goes. You must not be attached to the coming or the going. And so if our, you know, our delusions or our thinking, like he expresses there, not, you know, not reacting, you know, we sometimes in the us Dharma practitioners we have this idea of what enlightenment is. We hold ourselves to a certain, what's the word I'm looking for? We have a certain expectation of ourselves, or we're supposed to be like this, or it should be like this. And that's attachment thinking, like he says in there. So just, again, so not reacting. So if our thinking, even when it's delusional thinking, maybe it's not clear mind thinking, then we don't have to react. And so we do our best to try not to attach, but also we don't have to push it away. Just accept it. That moment, just accept, just come back to just now mind. And then like it takes care of itself. And then, you know, the clouds do part at some point. And then, yeah, the bright moon, clear mind is just right here. It's always right here. It never abandons us. It's always right here. So if our delusions, delusions are endless. We vow to cut through them all. So cutting through them all means just in our daily life, just being with our experience, accepting what is, and then upon the foundation of, you know, because our practice is, you know, however we do that, whatever practice we do to do it, the methodology technique doesn't matter, whether it's breath or what is this or a question or there's a million different practices that are available to us in the realm of Dharma, of course. So it doesn't matter what method we do or what technique, but it's just that coming back to just now, just this, just now. And as long as there's that effort, right? That's great effort. As long as that's that effort, then we're fine. And, you know, whether the clouds part in one millisecond or 10 seconds or 10 minutes or 10 hours or 10 days, whatever, it's just our effort. That's what's important. And and the teachings are infinite. We vow to learn them all. Again, everything. This doesn't mean memorizing all the sutras, hearing every Dharma talk that's available to us on the internet, or reading every book. No, that's that's not what this means, of course, and I know you know that. But it's everything, our experience every day is teaching us. And so, of course, and we have the wonderful opportunity to be exposed to the Dharma teachings, you know, through all sorts of different teachers, readings, talks, whatever. And that's wonderful, and that's a part of it for sure. That's why we have, you know, that's an important part, of course, of Sangha and practicing together and being supported by one another. So, of course, there's that part, some formal teaching and all. But then, you know, again, it's our experience. It's our experience that is so, you know, if we only read the Dharma and hear Dharma talks, but we don't show up in our everyday life and be with what is, you know, we can read all the Dharma books in the world, but if we're not doing it in our everyday life, those books and words are for nothing. They're rubbish. They'll never help our life. And again, I know you all know that. I know you all, everyone knows that. So the greatest teachings are from our experience, our practice, and are showing up and, you know, doing our best to show up in this moment, you know, and what, however that is for us, however that is. And the Buddha way is inconceivable. We vow to attain it. Yeah, it's inconceivable to the thinking mind. The fact that there is this place before thinking, before name and form, and that this I that we all, you know, are in our unawakened state, this false I, the false I, my me that we cling to, that we, you know, from early on, we, you know, and that grows and grows, we, you know, we believe in this false I, the separate I, and so it's to the thinking mind, it's inconceivable that I is simply a delusion. It doesn't exist, and we're not separate. So there is that awareness, that awakening before thinking, before name and form, before all the concepts and ideas, and that's where our true nature is. That's where our truth rests. And so it is inconceivable to the thinking mind, because we're so conditioned. To be attached to thinking and to this separate I. That's why the world, we have so much suffering, so much hatred, killing, separation. You know, we think we're separate. We make white person, we make black person, we make yellow person. That's attachment to name and form. That's stupid. That's so ignorant. And then we create all the suffering. And you're Chinese, I'm American, you're whatever, French, and you're a rock, whatever, all this separate, all this delusion, attachment to name and form. And so yeah, to the thinking mind, the regular thinking sentient being mind, it is inconceivable that there is this truth which is beyond all that. And then there's no place in the absolute, there's no place for it. That's just all delusion, that's all ignorance. So it is inconceivable. And but when we let go, when we go beyond the thinking mind, then it's just right here. It's right here. I want to share one other little story. I love these stories. And I know I shared this in the Zen group a week or two ago. So I know Steve heard this. And it's called Buddha is Grass Shoes. And I always love the story. So a long time ago in Korea, 300 years ago, it says, and I'm just going to look and then I'll read a little bit at the end, but most of it's like in just, paraphrase. There was this monk, Suk Du, which means rockhead. And he wasn't the brightest candle in the land, put it that way. And so first he went to some sutra master and temple, and he tried to study the sutras, but there was just it was way he couldn't get, it was way beyond, he couldn't get it. So he gave that up, and then he found this Zen master, Zen temple, and he went there. But practicing Zazen meditation was too difficult for him. He couldn't just sit. Probably just a lot of things, whatever, but he just, and he wasn't, he didn't like kind of, find the way with it. So anyway, so then he stayed at that temple, and then he became just like a working monk. He'd work in the kitchen, work in the field. So working was his practice, right? And he was very, very diligent, and he worked very hard. And then after some time, the Zen master, well, he said one day after he went, there was a Dharma speech, and but he never could understand what the master was. He couldn't get any of the, it just went beyond him. He couldn't grasp any of what the master ever said in his Dharma talks. And so one day after a Dharma talk, he went to the Zen master and he said, "Master, I'm tired of being so stupid. Isn't there some way I can understand?" And the master said, "You must ask me a good question." So Suk Du scratched his head and thought for a few minutes. Then he said, "Okay, you're always talking about Buddha. What is Buddha?" So, what is truth? What is absolute? And the master said, "Jukshim Shibo," Korean, which means Buddha is mind. And that's a very kind of common Zen kind of thing to say, Buddha is mind, right? But Suk Du, he misunderstood, and he thought that the teacher had said, "Egyptian Shibo," which means Buddha is grass shoes. So he thought, what a difficult koan, what a difficult question. A koan is a question that can't be answered with the thinking mind, conceptual mind. And then he thought, what a difficult question. He thanked the master, and he bowed and thanked him. He said, "Okay." And then he thought, how can Buddha be grass shoes? How will I ever understand? Like, what the hell is that? Buddha's grass shoes? And but he made this his practice, and every day he had this great question. Okay, Buddha's grass shoes, what is this? And just don't know. Buddha's grass shoes, don't know. So throughout the day he was working, eating, every, he just kept this question, Buddha's grass shoes, don't know, don't know. And then one day he was up in the hillside, he was collecting firewood, and then, back in those days, I guess in the summertime, the monks did wear shoes made out of grass. And probably not just the monks, but anyway, grass shoes were kind of, the thing. That's what they had. And he had all this wood on this harness thing on his back piled up, and he was going back down the hill, and he tripped on a rock, and then he fell and tumbled, and the firewood went, flying, and his shoes came off too, and they went flying, and they landed in front of him, and they were broken. They were, whatever, the grass, it was, broken, the grass closure, whatever. And at that moment, his mind opened, and he had this great awakening. And he got it, you know. Anyway, his mind shot open, and so I'll just read the rest. He was very so Duxu was very happy and very excited. He had this happiness that he had never experienced before in his life, and he went running to the Zen master, and he said, "Master, master, now I understand what Buddha is." And the master looked at him and said, and master could already see, something happened here. And then he looked at him and he said, "Oh, then what is Buddha?" And Duxu would kind of run down here. He put the shoes back on as best he could. He took one of the grass shoes off and he hit the master on the head with it. This is Zen. In Zen, this kind of stuff can happen. he hit the master on the head and the master said, "Is this the truth?" And Sukdu said, "My shoes are all broken." And the master burst out laughing, and Sukdu flushed with joy. So my shoe, he got it. So, you know, so yeah, at that moment, you know, he just saw his shoes were broken, and like, and it was just, he attained this moment. So Buddha's grass shoes, at that moment, he just saw his broken grass shoe, Buddha's grass shoe. Buddha is just this moment. So he was free. So at that, you know, at that time, you know, then, you know, that we can say that is a manifestation, an attainment of the four great vows, you know. At that moment, he saved all sentient beings. In that moment, he cut through all delusions. At that moment, he attained all the teachings. And at that moment, he attained the Buddha way, right? So just that moment, right? And so it's like De Sanxin wrote in that little teaching I read before, the moon, clear mind of the moon, or whatever. I can't remember what the title of that little thing is. You know, so just you know, like one moment. So in enlightenment and us manifesting the four great vows, it's not that, you know, we don't have that, maybe that mind every single second or whatever. And that's not the point. But it's like De Sanxin said in there, we have that experience, that one moment, and then our practice. And of course, that is further and further cultivated. And it's not that we have that maybe every single second, because there is thinking, there is delusion. We do have difficult moments in our life. There are challenges, especially, you know, in the social, very much in, you know, in social societal life, there's all sorts of stuff. But it's always right here. It's right in front of us, right? And so just what is this right now? So just like that, he attained this moment. And so for all of us in our own practice every day, you know, every moment is our opportunity just to meet this moment just as it is. And so our practice is just continuously that coming back. And, you know, and I love that practice of what is this? I love it on the cushion and formal practice, and also off the cushion in everyday life and informal practice in the context of everyday life. Because, you know, when we ask ourselves really that question, whether again, in formal practice or informal, what is this? It can help us just to come back to just this, just now, right? And, you know, and then sometimes in our practice, in our life, on the cushion, off the cushion, you know, sometimes we have these moments, like he had that big moment there. Sometimes we have these moments where there is some, you know, there's like a deeper realization, epiphany of something, right? You know, and that's a deepening of something. But it doesn't matter. It's not about having that moment. It doesn't matter. But just even just coming back to this moment, just being here just as it is, it doesn't have to be a big splash or epiphany. Then we are cultivating, we are deepening our awareness, our own enlightenment. And then the four great vows, can, you know, we can manifest them in our everyday life in this really organic and just natural and human way. The four great vows are totally human. They're not otherworldly. They're not holy. They're not separate from us. These things, you know, they're Buddhist, but it's not about Buddhists. These things are just within us. This part of our truth, this is just part of our true nature. So we can say they're Buddhist, but Buddha is just a word, just a name. We got to throw that out too. So they're not separate from us, these four great vows. They are they're part of our true nature of who we really are. So for me, I would say that they're just totally natural. You know, I get it that they're Buddhist and Buddhist words and lingo, but that's not the point of them. So.